Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, welcome to New Books in Music, a podcast of the New Books Network. I'm Kristen Turner, and my guest today is Dr. Kuni Ohara, author of a new book from the 33rd and a Third series called My Neighbor Totoro Soundtrack, a beloved Japanese anime movie released in 1988. My Neighbor Totoro tells the story of two sisters, Satsuki and Mei, as they deal with the separation from their mother, who is in the hospital, and their adventures with the forest creatures they meet called the Totoro. Hara analyzes the film's score and image song collection composed by Joe Hisaishi. The film's catchy theme song, along with the rest of the music, contribute to the film's nostalgic exploration of children's inner lives and the power of imagination to combat the very real traumas of childhood. I'm so glad you can join me today, Kunio.
Hello, Kristen. Thank you so much for having me here.
Oh, I'm excited to talk about your book today. You know, I know you as a Puccini scholar, and this seems, at least on the surface, to be a really big departure from your normal work, or at least your other scholarship. So where did you get the idea for this book?
So this has been a very interesting kind of a foray for my regular scholarship. So what I write about in Puccini or opera in general is the idea of nostalgia. And as I was finishing my dissertation and trying to think about how to expand this idea, I thought about some of the things that makes me nostalgic. And I guess I grew up watching lots of anime or films, animated films. So then I thought about, there's something about the music that might have something to tell more about nostalgia. And that's how I went into exploring some of my favorite films when I was growing up. And these are some of films by Studio Ghibli. And that led me into watching newer and older Ghibli films that were available. Then eventually I wrote a little kind of conference paper that I presented at different places, and that seemed to do well. And at one of the conference, National Conference of Society for, Society for, I am getting tongue-tied. So AMS, American Musicological Society meeting, I gave a presentation about a series of four Studio Ghibli films, the use of music and nostalgia in these films. And the editor of the 33 and 3rd Japan, Noriko Manabe, approached me after a talk and suggested that I write something for the series, and that became the direct impetus for this book.
Can you tell me a little bit about the 33 and a Third series? There's a lot of books in that series, and they're quite unique, and I'd love to learn more about that.
Yeah, so 33 and a Third is a series of short books. This has been going on for years now, and they have more than 100 books. And these are small in terms of size. It's about, 6 inches tall and 3 or 4 inches wide. Each of the volume originally were intended to highlight a famous or iconic album. So the 33 and a third is a reference to the speed in which, you know, LPs rotate. So these were albums of, you know, pop music artists, rock artists, jazz artists. And as the series expanded, they have expanded into international kind of music scene. And there are at least three series. So 33 and a third Japan, 33 and a third Brazil and Europe. And the Japan series have explored not only famous albums by famous artists, but also soundtracks of anime. And also there's another very interesting book on the phenomenon of Vocaloid, this kind of a synthetic voice music making software, and then the idol attached to it.
So I do like this series. It's compact, and you know, for something like what you've done, it seems perfect because it's one movie with a, you know, sort of a circumscribed world, but you can also talk about a lot of things that a lot of different topics that come out of your consideration of the soundtrack. So it seems like it's a perfect fit for that series.
I thought so too, because of the size, like you say, and also the audience is quite different from the usual audience I write for, which is mostly academics and other Puccini scholars. And this was a chance for me to expand how I write and how I think about music as well.
Yeah, it's great. So I guess I want to sort of start at the beginning. One of the very first things you talk about is the theme song. And you've got some really cute anecdotes about how you have heard that theme song, and one day some people saw you in a, I think it was a parking lot, and started singing it to you. And it's just very sweet. And it seemed, and my kids actually, I asked them about the movie and they started singing the theme song too. So what do you think it is about the theme song, which, as you point out, isn't even heard in its entirety till the credits?
Yeah.
You know, what makes that theme song so so catchy and really defines the movie in a way, which a good theme song should, but doesn't, you know, in many movies does not?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I just like to kind of, the story that I told in the book is that I was sitting in a parking lot, in a supermarket parking lot. I was looking up recipe before I went to shopping. And I had a little decal of Totoro on my car, like a back of my car, and I had the, I guess, a window open, right? So I hear this like a minivan stop parked next to me, and you know, it's, there's a young man and his children in the car, and they look at my decal and they say, oh, there's a Totoro, and they start singing, right? And I get out of the car and they say hi, a little bit embarrassed, but so I thought this was a kind of amazing episode, because not only the response to this image was music, right? So this made me think, oh, you know, so there is something about this song and the way that people associate this film with not only the film itself, but music. And so I go into, I guess, some detail about the structure, how the song is put together, as well as how the song was marketed. So in Japan, the way that the song came about is through this pre-release. So before the film appeared, the composer and Joe Hisaishi and the film director Hayao Miyazaki got together and put together a song album, and with a collaboration of another poet, Nakagawa Rieko is her name. My Neighbor Totoro, the song, was one of the first songs that came out in the market. And I think because of that, the song itself may have been more popular too. But as a song itself, it also played during the, you know, promotional spot on TV and film theaters for the film, as well as as a kind of a standalone thing that you can buy and purchase. But I think the song itself has a lot of many you know, many musical qualities that makes it approachable, memorable. There's lots of repetition in the song. It starts off as repetition of the name Totoro, right? Totoro, Totoro. And it goes on like that for a while. The song has, it's easy to sing and memorable, but at the same time, there are some really nice, you know, features such as, you know, some rhythmic complexities and use of different, you know, chromatic chords that I think makes the song not only approachable, but nice to listen to. And there's something about the song that makes it repeated listening to it makes it more comfortable perhaps, but also, you know, it's hard to say to capture the essence of the song.
Yeah, I went to listen to it. I haven't seen the film, I have to say, but I did listen to the song, and it's got one of those earworm qualities in the chorus, right? Which I don't know what it is, but once you hear it, something about the simplicity of the melodic line, maybe. But it also has this kind of sort of wide-eyed innocence about it, especially in the chorus, that I guess that's what I associate anime that's designed for children with, like those big eyes and the kind of there's a certain amount of optimism to it, I guess, that reminds me of just the visual style. And I don't know if that's part of the answer or not, but that's sort of what I was thinking about as well when I was reading your book and then listening to the song.
That's so interesting. Yeah. So I think there's go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, the song is very optimistic, right? I think it starts off with this collection of high-pitched percussion instruments in this very active rhythmic kind of groove that is repeated. It's repetitive. It's high volume. You hear this solo. There are a couple of different versions, but most versions of the recording of the song, you hear a solo vocalist. And her name is Inoue Azumi, and a chorus of men, I think, in the background. So I think the song suggests sonically this idea of group singing, right? And I think this is an invitation for the audience to also sing along. And because the chorus is so catchy, or the kind of hook is so catchy and simple and repetitive, it's easy to repeat it, right? It becomes this thing that we can all participate. And I think that there's some kind of joy in this listening, but also singing along.
So you mentioned the this image album or image song collection that was released prior to the movie, which from what I understand from your book is a pretty common marketing technique. But it seems that then that sort of, I guess, pot of music, so to speak, became not only important for the composer in shaping the film's score, but also informed the collaboration that he had with the filmmaker, Miyazaki. So can you talk a little bit about that collaboration and how the music informed the film and vice versa?
Yeah, so this is a particularly interesting aspect of Japanese animation from this time period, so the late 80s and 90s and on. So this practice was apparently started with Studio Ghibli films, where the kind of producing team would commission a composer to put together a kind of concept album based on the characters or images or keywords or concept that in this case, Miyazaki put together, and then Hisaishi would write music for it. And this was meant to for the composer to test out some ideas, but apparently it became a source of inspiration for the film director. So in this case, again, Miyazaki, we have accounts of him listening to these songs while he was writing and creating the film, right? And in this particular case, so there's several earlier films that Miyazaki and Hisaishi collaborated. The first one was called Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind. And for this, Hisaishi was approached by the producer, who was Takahata Isao, to compose the music for the image album from the film. He composed the image album. They went on sale before the film was created. But in the process, Miyazaki listened to the film, listened to the album repeatedly, and then created music, so much so that he wanted to hire Hisaishi to do the soundtrack of the film itself. So this image album, the soundtrack, was not always the path of creation, but this kind of became solidified after that. And another film that they collaborated is called The Castle in the Sky, and then My Neighbor Totoro came after that. But for My Neighbor Totoro, Miyazaki wanted Hisaishi to not only create an image album, which was mostly, in previous cases, were instrumental music, a kind of a synthesized music, or music for the synthesizer. And for My Neighbor Totoro, Miyazaki wanted a collection of songs with text, right? And so what he did was to hire a famous Japanese children's book author called Nakagawa Rieko, and Miyazaki and his team commissioned her to write several poems to be set as songs, and hired Hisaishi to write music for these poems. Miyazaki himself then ended up providing some of the poems for this image album. So there are about three or four songs that Miyazaki wrote the text for. And the song that we talked about earlier, My Neighbor Totoro, is actually written by Miyazaki. This suggests that these three people had frequent meetings over, how to, write music. But only so I think this collaboration reminded me a lot of actually opera composition, where we have these traces of how this people collaborated through letters and accounts. But it's clear that it was not always the case that the lyricist or the poet provided the text and composer set the music. No, there's lots of interaction between poet setting the text and musician saying, can you fix this or fix that? And then the poet responding, yes, no. And there's somebody in between trying to negotiate the dynamics or the personal conflicts of the collaborating team. So what this suggested to me was that music for this film was actually an important part of the film itself. And in many cases, music for many films is a kind of a post-production process where the film has been completed and then the composer is hired or asked to write music for the completed film. In this case, creation of music preceded the completion of the film, and the music seemed to have articulated, in this case, because there are songs with text, some of the major themes of the film that you would see later. So I thought this process was an extremely interesting thing to trace as much as it's possible to do. And and it's kind of surprising coincidence, or rather similarity to what I know about how Puccini worked with his librettist, I thought was interesting and fascinating.
That is really interesting. I had not thought about it in relation to opera until you brought it up, but you're absolutely right. That's quite interesting. And actually, that brings up sort of in my mind your other work that I'm familiar with, which is on nostalgia in Puccini. And so you also talk a lot about nostalgia in this. You talk a lot about nostalgia in this movie as well. So can you talk a little bit about, what is the role of nostalgia in the film, and then how does the music support that theme?
Yeah. So nostalgia is it's a concept that I've been thinking about, writing about, reading about a lot, and it's a fascinating one. The way that I think about nostalgia is that, so first of all, the word nostalgia is relatively new, and it was invented in around the late 17th century. And there's an error in the book. There's a typo that says 18th century, but it should be 17th century. There's a Swiss doctor who diagnosed the first case of nostalgia that we know of, or first cases of nostalgia that we know of. And these were a form of kind of a very serious or fatal form of homesickness that he observed among Swiss people. So nostalgia at the beginning was this kind of idea of people losing the will to survive or live in this kind of extreme emotional situation where they're separated from their homes, so the homesickness. And over the course of the century or centuries, nostalgia transitions into this medical condition, longing for home to something more poetic or more evocative, kind of longing for a lost time. And as the 19th century progressed, this idea of nostalgia can be fatal kind of fades to the background. And nostalgia becomes this kind of a sign of sensitivity or kind of emotional state of mind. And Puccini kind of lived in this time when this transition happens or transition recently happened. So in Puccini's opera, you have this kind of collapse of longing for time and longing for a space, home. And I tried to trace that in many of his works. But in My Neighbor Totoro, I think music also plays a role of nostalgia on one sense for me and many, I guess, people of my generation. You know, this film is already 30 years old, and listening to music from this film kind of reminds us of the time when we first watched the film or saw the film or, you know, in the previous years. So music has this ability to inspire past memories, right? And very early on, this idea of music as trigger of nostalgia was talked about among doctors and scientists already in the 18th century. The very early cases, and these are kind of tossed as kind of a strange story in medical discourse. But there were cases of Swiss soldiers who were mercenaries fighting wars in different places, listening to something called Rensauvage, and these are the often translated as a cow herding song. So if you remember the third movement of Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, there's this long extended English horn, cor anglais solo, right? And that is understood to be this kind of a music that shepherds are playing in the distance. And this kind of music apparently inspired so much sorrow and longing for home among the Swiss soldiers that they would lose their will to fight or even they get sick. So this kind of music was banned among certain armies. And this was this kind of story that circulated in the 18th century. But I think it's true today that we tend to attach music with this magical ability to inspire memory and actually fond longing from the past. So that's why I kind of talked about music in this film as well. Now, the question is whether music itself, there's something about the structure of music that can inspire nostalgia. And I try to kind of explore the idea. I guess in some sense, music can inspire nostalgia by imitating musical style from the earlier decades. In this case, I talk about how some of these famous songs from My Neighbor Totoro reminds or is created specifically to imitate a kind of music that was sung at school. And this is something that I explore more in the book, but their repertory of school songs that was cultivated in Japan starting in the late 19th century, and these are called shoka. And these were songs that were meant to be sung at school by elementary or kindergarten students, or even later middle school students. That was easy to sing as a form of music education, right? And these songs have fairly predictable structure. Most of them are strophic, most of them are syllabic, most of them are easy to sing together as a group. And many of them were actually based on European and American models. In other words, folk songs from, you know, the British Isles, or American tune songs were often used in the late 19th century with Japanese text. And this is part of the more longer history of importation of Western music in Japan. But there are many ways in which the music from My Neighbor Totoro were inspired by this repertory of music, or rather this idea of a group of children singing together. And I think to some degree, this idea of singing together as if we were children can inspire a sense of nostalgia among the adults in the audience. So that's one take on it.
Yeah, no, I as I was listening to your answer, I was also thinking about how that, you know, that association between specific that are culturally specific and nationally specific experiences and music can be very strong. Like the kinds of children's song you were talking about, someone outside of Japan might not have that association with the music because they weren't educated in Japan. But we're looking here at My Neighbor Totoro is a film that is popular worldwide. It's not only important in Japanese cult pop culture, but it's one of these Japanese cultural exports, anime in general, but this movie in particular. And I think you talk a lot about that in the book in terms of nationalism and how certain things that certain sounds and certain pieces of music seem to evoke or can evoke ideas about nationalism, but because it's an international phenomenon, you know, different people are going to maybe experience that quite differently. And one of the songs that you point that out for is Path of the Wind, which some people find to be Japanese, like the melody is somehow sounds Japanese to them, and other people don't hear that at all. Can you talk a little bit about that song and sort of just the idea of how do you talk about nationalism in a piece of music that is international, but also very much rooted in a particular time and place?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for asking that. And I hope I can answer that, because the song that you talked about, Path of the Wind, is it's another very famous song. So in the film, you hear this music throughout the film in different guises, but the most memorable scene is when the children, Satsuki and Mei, bury this, you know, bunch of acorns in the yard, and one night, a group of Totoro come, and they help, they do this little dance, and this acorns grow into sprout into a gigantic tree, and then you have this beautiful music that you hear. And there are many description of this particular scene of the film. Many critics or scholars have talked about the Japanese element in the film. And when I talk to other people that have seen the film, they do. And other people where I live, which is mostly, so I live in South Carolina, and my colleagues are mostly Caucasian colleagues, and they talk about how this music sound Japanese or exotic, right? And there are some qualities to that perception, because the music is in this pentatonic scale, a five-note scale that is often found in Japanese folk music and traditional music, but not necessarily in other contexts. And there's something ungainly, well, not ungainly, but it's something peculiar about the way the melody progresses. And this particular piece of music was originally created as a song. And this is something not many people know about. But in the Image album, Image Song Collection, you can listen to this song sung by children's chorus. And it's a beautiful, I think, a tune, catchy, and very evocative. And partly because of the instrumentation, Hisaishi uses a lot of, again, percussion instruments, mostly, I think, synthesizers. But because of the way that the timbre is really hard to kind of figure out what the sound is like, it's bell-like, but it also like lots of percussion, drums, and it gives this quality of strangeness. And what, based on what Hisaishi wrote about the music, he intended this music to sound to his ears exotic, rather, which means that it was meant to sound non-Japanese but non-Western as well, something more close to music of, other cultures. And to me, this kind of gap between how people in America or US perceives this music and how this music was intended by, or rather talked about by Hisaishi, was interesting, because, as you say, it's evoke a sense of Japanese-ness to some people, but it was purportedly, or rather it was kind of thought of as being non-Japanese by the composer. And I go back and forth between when I listen to this tune, it does sound vaguely Japanese, but to me it also sounds strange. And I think this kind of boundary between the familiarity and unfamiliarity, this kind of ambiguous nature of the song or the music, fits the particular context in which is deployed in the film, which is this fantastical scene. So this is a film that I think was, intended clearly for Japanese kind of domestic consumption, right? It's about this particular moment in Japanese history. The film is taking place in like the late 50s, early 60s. Which for people who lived in Japan in the 80s was a moment of kind of a simpler time, right? So in the late 80s, Japan has kind of achieved this. It was at the height of its kind of economic might, you might say, right before the kind of a collapse of 89 later. I think there was there's things were plentiful. People had lots of wealth was being accumulated very at the rapid pace. At the same time, there's sense of kind of social ills that were surfacing, mostly about kind of a dissolution or collapse of traditional family structures. And I think at this moment, there's something comforting about thinking back at the past in a simpler time in the past. Immediately after World War II, but it was right before the, at the beginning of the economic kind of recovery. There's something hopeful about simpler time of that period. And then also seeing how this particular family struggle with this kind of unstable family kind of a crisis that was happening. So that has gone way away from the music, but but this is to say that the film has a very specific cultural significance that meant something for audience, not only in Japan, but Japanese audience in the 80s, right, late 80s. But it still seems to resonate with a lot of people today in Japan. And as you have told, and as many people have told me, that this is a film that has done very well abroad and other places. So what is great about, for me, to write this book was that I was able to kind of trace what I find in this film that's interesting. And I think this kind of writing would inspire other people to kind of understand or try to share why they think the film is important to them, or why do they think the film is important to the context in which they live. You know, because I think there's like any complex work of art, it has many ways in which it can resonate with the people. And I think there are ways in which the film is meaningful to people outside of Japan that are not intended to be as such, but nevertheless still important to kind of think about.
You talked in that answer about how the composer had a specific idea in mind of what he thought he was trying to write anyway, at least that's what he said publicly, but yet it's received rather differently by some audiences, at least in that particular song. And you also quote him as saying that his music is minimal and ethnic.
Yes.
And what does that mean?
That is an interesting label, right? So he uses this label. So in his autobiography called I Am, and he talks about his film music style, and one is, you know, he calls it Hisaishi melody, or this kind of a tuneful music that he writes for many films. And then the other is other side of his composition is minimal ethnic, and this is a word that he uses in Japanese. Minimal is easier to understand because it's about as a music student, composition student, he was inspired by the music of Terry Riley, Philip Glass, and Steve Reich, and others. Early on in his compositional career, he wrote a lot of minimalist composition inspired by these American avant-garde experimental composers. And you have a trace of that in some of this kind of repetitive rhythmic structure in many of his composition, many of the accompaniment, even in My Neighbor Totoro, has this repetitive quality that is very driven, or has a direct connection to minimalism. Now, the ethnic part is kind of strange, not strange, but it's more complicated. And partly because he uses the word in Japanese, ethniku, which is a transliteration of the English word ethnic. So there's a word for ethnic in Japanese, which is minzoku, right? There's a Japanese word for that. But he consciously used a kind of English word, or evokes the English word ethnic with the word ethniku. And I think the word ethnic or ethnic was chosen to denote that this is a kind of view at the world, not only from the standpoint of being Japanese, but almost standpoint of somebody in Japan who adopted the way that the Westerners look at the world. So that's one idea. Another is that his word ethnic tend to refer to kind of a non-Western, non-classical, but traditional musical styles from other parts of the world, but not Japanese, right? Because he would have used the word Japanese music or Japanese traditional music or the Japanese word minzoku to describe this kind of ethnic music. So I think he was trying to evoke the kind of soundscape that was not necessarily traditional in the sense of traditional Japanese music or traditional Western music, classical music, but music from other parts of the world. In this case, he, in earlier kind of exploration, he uses inspirations from West African drummings, the kind of predominance of the bell-like tone, percussive sound in many of his songs. And My Neighbor Totoro suggests music from Indonesia or Bali or Gamelan, right? So I think these are some of the reasons why he chose the this kind of label, minimal ethnic.
One of the, I guess, types of music maybe he had in mind when he was talking about his music being ethnic was jazz, which is important in several of the selections of the film. Can you talk a little bit about sort of his use of jazz, but also what is the significance of jazz within the Japanese musical landscape?
So jazz, jazz is a, I think there's many, many elements of jazz in this soundtrack, especially in the film score version of it. But jazz was, Japanese people were very taken by jazz early on. So we have, record of, rather very, very clear history of jazz reception in Japan starting in the 1920s and 30s. And this was a very important genre style of popular music in Japan before World War II. During World War II, actually the Pacific War, after Japan's bombing of Pearl Harbor and when Japan and US went into war, jazz goes underground, right? Because it's a kind of a, become symbol of what, the music of the enemy nation. But jazz becomes much more, recovers or rather survives the war and has a kind of a boom or blossoming in during the occupation when after the war in 1945, the American occupation starts almost immediately and lasts until 1951. There's lots of American musicians, American GIs who perform jazz, and Japanese musicians, jazz musicians especially, were hired to play in these, for entertainment of these troops. And jazz has this enormous revival in Japan. So this is to say that jazz was one of the style of popular music that was already kind of has developed into a native style of music by this, obviously by the film was released in 1980s, but much earlier. So in that sense, it is not surprising to see some traces of jazz in this film.
So as you were talking, I was wondering, the composer's style, Hisayashi, I'm saying that correctly, his style, is that sort of using elements of music from a lot of different cultures? So he uses bagpipe, for instance, in one of the songs, and then you were pointing out that he uses Balinese influences and then this jazz influence. Is that typical of composers of his era that, are trying to use influences from everywhere? We see that in American composers as well, and lots of other composers that are very excited by having so many different musical traditions that they can draw upon that have both become kind of fundamental to Japanese culture, but then maybe others not so much. Or is this an attempt by a film composer to make a score that would be approachable by people all over the world for a film that's going to be seen by people all over the world?
That is a great question. The second part, whether the composer intended this film to sound a certain way to have popular appeal. So the way I think about this film is that the film itself was, I don't think it was intended for international release right away. Now, Studio Ghibli, has has a deal with Disney later on that suggests that Studio Ghibli wanted to release its product abroad. But Totoro was a surprising hit domestically as well. And internationally, it was a, you know, people didn't expect this to do well. So, and it is unlikely. And what is also interesting is that, so Hisaishi collaborates with Miyazaki later on, right? And he composes music for all of Miyazaki's film after, you know, for a while now. And later films like Princess Mononoke or The Wind Rises are much more symphonic in this kind of traditional Hollywood mold. And this apparently was his attempt to make the film more, Hisaishi's attempt to make the film more, approachable, appealing to the worldwide audience, right? But the first point about whether this was a common thing among other Japanese composers, and I think that, I need to do more kind of exploration of this genre of music, but my the little I know is that this is the case, right? So I want to say that this is the case, and this has to do something with the ability of Japanese composers, or rather consumers, to have access to this market. So Japan is like the second biggest market of recorded music in some statistics, and if you go to, you know, there are Tower Records in Japan still, and if you go to record store in Japan, the, you know, it is full of not only domestic music, excuse me, but also music from all over the world, including popular music, but also traditional and folk music. And there's a great interest in the music from all over the world in Japan that enables composers then to draw on this all this tradition. And I think there's something to do with this, the development of market in Japan that enables them to, the composers then to use lots of resources.
That's really interesting. It always amazes me how you start with a small kernel, which in this case is the soundtrack to one movie, and it just explodes into all these different aspects, cultural aspects, historical aspects, etc. I wanted to ask one last question before we start to end this interview. And that's about the theme of isolation in the movie. I'm keenly aware of that right now. We are taping this in March of 2020 when the whole world is approaching lockdown, and most of us are isolated in our homes much more than we are used to. And so as I was reading about the film and realizing that that's a big theme of the movie, that Satsuki and Mei are missing their mother who is isolated from them, and I guess Mei gets lost in the movie as well. So can you talk a little bit about how the music supports that theme of the rigors of isolation and the sadnesses of isolation?
Yeah. So in the film, it is not clear why their mother is in isolation. The film itself, but you know, the writings about the film and interviews suggest that, Satsuki and Mei's mother is suffering from tuberculosis. And this is a theme that comes back in Miyazaki's later film, as well as Wind Rises. There's another character who is diagnosed with tuberculosis and has to kind of be in isolation. And this TB was a, very serious illness still, but more so in Japan in this time period in the mid-20th century. And this was not uncommon for people to have this kind of experience. And I was, like you say, as I was thinking about this interview, I thought to myself, we do all kind of feel a little bit, this came into mind as well, this idea of isolation. And here we have the music, there's a song that is included in the Image Song collection called Mother, Okasan, and also another song called Maigo, Lost Child. And these two songs, especially the song Mother, really kind of captures this idea of being away from one's loved one and trying to reach out and turning them. So it's a charming song, quite sad actually, that is not sung in the film itself, but you hear the instrumental version of this when the girls visit mother. The poetry of the song talks about how this protagonist wants to turn herself into a bird so she can fly away to her mother, or turns away to the rabbit so she can jump into mother's lap. And this a sense of longing, but something that should have been very easy to do, like, you know, getting close to your mother is prohibited because of this illness. And I think the song does so in a very simple language, straightforward poetry. And then the music, of course, kind of supports that sentiment. Now, but what is interesting is that you have to, you would not know the kind of a text of the song when you just listen to the film, but you have to kind of listen to the song as song and listen to the lyrics to understand the meaning of the song. And then that enhances the image, what you see in the film. And I think that's why this image song collection is so important and interesting. And the other song, the Lost Child, is also used in a similar way, that the song itself describes this kind of sense of the fear of losing, another family member. In this case, I think it's sung from the point of view of Satsuki, the older sister, who worries that her younger sister may have gotten lost, or rather she's lost and she can't find her. And again, this is told in a very straightforward language, clear to understand in the song, and the music returns in the film, but as an instrumental number when Satsuki is running around the countryside trying to seek out Mei. And you have this very mournful music that is in the background. And, you get the meaning of this music, but if you had listened to the song itself and heard the lyrics, understood it, you have a better, even more deeper understanding.
That intertextual element of the score is really interesting, because you don't get that very often. You usually just have the one sonic artifact of the film, mm-hmm. and you don't have the second one that you can listen to draw upon. Yeah. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's almost like how people use existing music, right? To borrow music that already exists and puts in film. In this case, they did this process twice, almost like twice. They have to create the music first and then create the film. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've finished this big project now. The book is out. What are you working on now?
So I am working on going back to Puccini and trying to turn my dissertation into a book. So this is this project should have come after that, but the opportunity came. So I was already working on the Puccini book. So I'm going to try to explore this idea of nostalgia as a longing for time and space as a theme that runs through most of Puccini's work. And I try to kind of trace and understand Puccini's composition from that standpoint. I'm also working on several smaller articles, chapter in the collection more about anime. I'm turning my attention to Takahata Isao, who was a collaborator of Miyazaki, and he himself directed several films, including The Grave of Fireflies, which is a very sad tale of two young siblings who try to survive in the aftermath of World War II and kind of do not succeed. And what is interesting in this is the fact that this film, The Grave of the Fireflies, was shown simultaneously with My Neighbor Totoro as a double bill, right? So this is another interaction between the two. So these are some of the project I'm looking at right now.
Well, I look forward to getting a chance to read all the work that you're working on now, and maybe we can have another interview when your Puccini book comes out.
That'll be fantastic. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. And once again, this is Kristen Turner with New Books in Music, a podcast of the New Books Network. And I've been speaking to Kunio Hara about his book, My Neighbor Totoro Soundtrack.
Thank you so much, Kristen. Stay safe.
You too. Keep washing those hands.